Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are privileged to have with us, on occasion, Diana West. In fact, every week, just about, one of the most intelligent people I know, one of the most thoughtful, particularly when it comes to matters of culture and politics and national security. She is a blogger at dianawest.net, a longtime syndicated columnist. You find her writings these days from time to time at the Daily Caller and elsewhere. She is the author of two extraordinarily important books, very much germane to our present topic, The Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Diana West, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Well, it is wonderful to have you because I want to talk with you about, as I say, the present topic, nationalism. President Trump has proudly announced that he considers himself to be a nationalist. He is being widely reviled for doing so by all of the usual suspects. I'd like you to tease out for us what you think that term means, why those who can that it has to do with white nationalism or some other kind of dog whistling to odious people are wrong, and why it may be of such incredible importance to have this very clearly laid out at this particular moment in our history.
Yes, well, this is Donald Trump at his best, shattering taboos and forcing people to rethink the language and rethink, yes, their identity, our identity as Americans who live in a nation state, who love our nation state and want to restore it. Because what we are actually watching is Donald Trump taking his counter-revolution forward. That's not her hyperbole. This is absolutely the most massive reorientation of the United States of America that I have ever lived through. And calling himself a nationalist is another advance in this effort to restore our nation, which has essentially gone through an attrition, really particularly since the end of World War II, as the global system has become entrenched and as our national definition has been lost inside it. And this started when he came down the escalator, at Trump Tower when he had declared his candidacy in 2015 and talked about a wall. That is the first step, and this is part of the sort of psychological wall that we need to sort of re-engineer to understand who we are and how we can survive.
Right. Yeah, let's talk about specifically what he means by nationalism. What do you think is implied by that, besides having secure borders, which became, you know, shorthanded as the wall? What does it mean in terms of our sovereignty, in terms of our relationship to other nations? You know, America first, again, another of his catchphrases. Stitch these dots together, please.
Yeah. Well, I think the easiest way to understand it is to be an American, not a citizen of the world. Citizens of the world are not nationalists, and yet this concept is what our children have been taught. Our children are taught to be citizens of the world, beginning literally in nursery school and kindergarten. I know that, having watched my own daughters go through this process and have to be re-educated at home, of course. But this is the curriculum that our kids are being brainwashed by.
Yeah, a product of the left, which has marched through the institutions, as they say, with this sort of cultural Marxist agenda. And globalism, I think it's fair to say, your research certainly bears this out, is the handmaiden of socialism, which is the order of the day for the hard left seeking to replace America or take it down at the very least, right?
Even more than a handmaiden, I think it's just a different iteration of the same concept of a global system in which nations disappear.
Starting with ours.
Yes, and I think that it was very close to disappearing, particularly 8 years after Obama, and had we entered into a Hillary Clinton presidency, we would have seen complete disappearance, perhaps by the end of, as she got into her term. This has been reversed. This is why this is a counter-revolution, because what we've undergone in the past, say, 80 years is a slow revolution against nationalism, against the nation state. And we need to address the fact that the people try to poison the term by referring to Nazi Germany as the kind of standard bearer of nationalism, which is a misnomer on so many historical levels, particularly when you look at the efforts of Hitler to conquer all of Europe and make it into a giant supranational state, which frankly, people, has been done by the machinations of the European Union, which was always very much taking the Nazi blueprint for Europe. I mean, this is the great hidden irony of the pan-Europa movement and the rest of it.
Interestingly enough, under the strong influence of the Germans, no less. They were not alone, but post-war Germany was very much involved in advancing this this takeover. And Diana, just walk us through this very quickly. You have done heroic work in this space, as has Dinesh D'Souza. But one of the arguments that the left is giving for why nationalism must be rejected is that it's the first word in national socialist. And they would have us believe that this is all part of the right's effort to, return to Nazism, speaking of the Germans and their agenda. What is, in fact, the DNA, the political and ideological DNA of national socialism? And how does it differ from the nationalist agenda of Donald Trump?
Yes, well, of course, they will say anything to undermine and eliminate this potent political standard of, again, America. I mean, the idea that it has anything to do with Nazism is absurd. National socialism is socialism. It begins, from the root of Marx. It has much more in communism with communism than anything else in terms of the central control by the dictatorship. I mean, it has nothing to do with our system or what they're talking about. I mean, it would be as if to say we can't call ourselves democratic because the Soviets had democratic republics. I mean, these are just flim-flam terms. And what you're seeing is not the Democrats and the left trying to find truth and light and a better way of communicating. They are, again, trying to corrode and destroy our language so that we cannot successfully defeat them and reassert these very important ideas. Yes, it's political warfare, and this is about becoming a patriot again.
Diana West, thank you for your time today. Next up, speaking of open borders, we'll talk about the caravan heading our way with Michael Waller right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's my pleasure to say, joined by a longtime friend and close colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Vice President for Government Affairs, Michael Waller. Dr. Waller brings a lot to that particular portfolio and to our conversation today. He, among other things, was active and living in Central America during the Reagan administration as wars were being fought to try to prevent people hostile to this country from taking over one or more of the nations there. Mike Waller was active in trying to stave that off. He is a specialist, a PhD, in political warfare. He has taught in a number of institutions, including Boston University and also the Institute of World Politics. He is an extraordinary resource whose brain I'm anxious to pick about the caravan and more heading from, among other places, Guatemala. Mike, before we get to all that, though, first of all, a welcome to you. But second, I'd be interested in the conversation that we just had with Diana West about Donald Trump announcing himself to be a nationalist and the importance of that comment as it relates specifically to this idea of a sovereign nation that has borders that it is entitled to defend, and why it's important that it do so.
Well, it's the definition of what a nation state is, what a country is. It has recognized, legally defined borders, and countries are entitled to enforce those borders and who comes in and comes out by whatever means they have to. I was an illegal alien in two Central American countries years ago, and in one of those countries, the guys with guns chased me out. So if the Central Americans feel comfortable and in their right to defend themselves against illegal immigrants, certainly we shouldn't be afraid of it either.
Yeah, and you've pointed out over the years that the Central Americans, notably the Mexicans, have very, very restrictive laws on their books concerning immigration, especially how they treat illegal immigrants. This is against the backdrop of a lot of complaints that we're hearing from that part of the world and its leftist agitators in place and imported for the purpose. In connection with this caravan business, Mike, talk a bit about, based on your experience in the region, what this caravan looks to you to be about and who is populating it.
Well, the caravan is definitely organized by outside interests with a lot of money. When these illegal immigrant groups migrate up to the United States, the last thing they bring with them are tiny, helpless babies and very small children who need a lot of tending to. Making these trips is very dangerous. Most of the children and women are abused and raped along the way. They suffer extreme hardship. So bringing a baby on a 2,000-mile trek is the last thing you do unless you want to use them for props. So that's the first thing.
And unless somebody is facilitating your trip, too, which I think is also taking place here, as I understand it.
Right. There's a huge logistical network that these Hondurans, or mainly Hondurans, are using, and they are large mass organizations and community organizer networks that were funded by the Cubans or the Venezuelans in the past, and then more recently funded by the European Union and the United States Agency of International Development.
Say that again. The United States AID is providing money to these caravan operations and others like them?
Yes, more accurately, you and I and all your listeners are paying for this caravan and the people who organize them through our tax dollars spent by USAID.
There's also reports, Mike Waller, that George Soros and some of his pals may be underwriting these kinds of operations. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, it sounds normal. It sounds sort of, you would sort of take it for granted that that's what they were doing. But we saw in Guatemala how some of the active groups, the local groups, had not only been funded by Soros's organizations, but in partnership with the U.S. Agency for International Development. This has been going on for about 25 years, and no one's been watching.
Wow. Mike, you mentioned Guatemala. Some of these folks in the caravan are coming from there. You have been doing a lot of really important work, as have our friends at Judicial Watch, on the activities of another element of the United States government, in this case the State Department, specifically an ambassador by the name of Todd Robinson, who was for a time posted to Guatemala, then was posted to Venezuela, apparently got his butt thrown out of Venezuela, and now is running Central America policy at the Department of State. Tell us what Todd Robinson was doing that may have contributed to problems with the government in Guatemala's efforts to help us with these migrant problems and the concerns we have for our security as a result of them.
Well, Todd Robinson is a great example of the swamp in action. He's a career Foreign Service officer, but he was so politicized that Hillary Clinton picked him to be what her favorite operative for Central America. So he was working with radical groups, including demobilized communist guerrillas who'd been funded by Cuba and Venezuela. And now they'd gone civilian and they needed training on how to organize politically and legally. He was named U.S. ambassador to Guatemala under Barack Obama. He was down there for a few years and he was implementing a plan by the Soros Foundation funded people, as well as USAID, to elevate radical lawyers who they had trained to the most senior, most judicial posts in the country, and thereby try to take over the pro-U.S. conservative government of Guatemala and turn it into a Marxist regime by taking over the court system.
Now, you've said in the past, Mike Waller, that this was a play that, frankly, it looks a lot like what they've been trying to do in our own country, when you think about it, the activist courts and so on, when they can't win elections. Is that what was going on as an effort to really essentially overthrow the democratically elected government that represents the basically conservative people of Guatemala? And if so, how does that play into this current problem with illegal immigration from Guatemala and elsewhere in the region?
Yeah, the Guatemalan population as a whole is very anti-leftist, very anti-Marxist, quite conservative, culturally conservative, and the left has no hope of ever winning a national election in Guatemala. So what the left decided to do was take over the courts, because in the Guatemalan system, there are two top courts in the country, and the courts can issue rulings to force the president to do this or that, even to change government ministers. And if the president doesn't do that, he can be ousted by the courts in a legal fashion. And they've been trying to do that with President Morales, really a good friend of the United States. He is probably the best Central American leader, supporting us on fighting drug trafficking, fighting terrorists, and he just moved the Guatemalan embassy to Jerusalem, which is another very big step for that region. And and also he had a plan to help the United States fight illegal immigrant trafficking into Mexico, because Guatemala shares a 500-mile border with Mexico, and that's the funnel for illegal migration from Central America and South America up in through Mexico to the United States. Unfortunately, with people like Ambassador Todd Robinson in the system, not only was President Morales ignored, he was shunted aside, and they've been trying to remove him. It looks like this part of this caravan idea has been to undermine the pro-U.S. government in Honduras and the pro-U.S. government in Guatemala, and divert attention away from the Sandinista government's problems in Nicaragua, and stir up trouble during the Mexican presidential transition, because right now you have the rather moderate Mexican president is leaving and this far left anti-U.S. Mexican president-elect is coming in, all at the same time with the congressional elections that we're having. So somebody down there is stirring the pot at this precise time for a political goal.
And from what you say, Mike Waller, it would be counterproductive, I guess, to be denying funding to the governments of Guatemala and Honduras. It's an obvious point of leverage with them, but this would be the proverbial nose cutting to spite your face, it sounds like, if those governments are actually on our side and don't want this kind of illegal immigration any more than we do. Mike, so you've painted a picture here of a very problematic U.S. government, in part funded effort to subvert our sovereignty by enabling large numbers of illegal aliens to come across our border. The president has warned some of those people are probably from the Middle East and probably dangerous or criminals of other stripes. Again, based on your own experience in that region, and in particular on reports that for years the leftist governments of Venezuela under Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro have been giving Venezuelan passports to Iranians and other folks, raises the question when we're hearing from the journalists accompanying these caravans for the purpose, obviously, of promoting their political warfare agenda. There's no terrorists, there's no, you know, Middle Easterners in this company. Does that sound improbable to you?
Oh, no, it's been happening for years. Even passports to Hezbollah members. President Morales of Guatemala recently reported that they deported nearly 100 suspected ISIS members from Guatemala. I think that is probably the case because these areas are such a magnet for illegal immigrants from all over the world. If you're going to have people from Nepal and Bangladesh being smuggled up through Guatemala, you're certainly going to have ISIS.
Yeah, and we would expect some of them to get into these caravans as well?
Of course, to use them by whatever means they can, or to use the caravans as a diversion and go in by other means. All the cameras are on the caravan.
Yeah. Mike Waller, we'll be discussing more, I know, in the days ahead. Thank you very much for your time today and the terrific work you do with us at the Center for Security Policy, as well as the teaching that you have done over many years to raise a new generation of security policy practitioners. I'm grateful for all of that, Mike, as well as your friendship. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Harold Rode about the Khashoggi affair right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined, I'm very pleased to say, by a friend and colleague of many years. His name is Dr. Harold Rode. He is one of the smartest guys I've ever encountered on matters involving the Middle East. He had the portfolio in the Defense Department for decades of trying to make sense for senior policymakers there of what was going on in places like Iran and Turkey and Iraq and so much more. He has been an extraordinary resource for us. We have followed his work in places like the Gatestone Institute, and we have caught up with him in Israel, where he is spending some time at the moment. And Harold, thank you for taking the time to talk with us about several things, but I particularly am anxious to get your thoughts on the Khashoggi affair, the recent apparent murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Great to be here, Frank. Always wonderful to hear your voice.
So what are we to make of this apparent liquidation of an opponent of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and his government in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey?
Well, first of all, we have an internal Sunni war going on between the Muslim Brotherhood, and on that side is the Turkish dictator Erdogan, and Khashoggi. Oh, we hear you. He was an enemy of the Saudi state. We think of him as this wonderful guy, a journalist. What Khashoggi was a strident anti-Western member. He's a Muslim Brotherhood member. He advocated in support of the Saudis killing a major Saudi Shiite leader. We think of killing in terms of morality. They don't think of killing in terms of morality. It's a political necessity, so you do it. They do it. The Iranians do it. There is a phrase in Arabic, the religion of Muhammad comes through the sword. That's unfortunately how they solve problems most of the time, through internal violence. So we certainly should never be pro-Islamic, rather the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's what Khashoggi was. This was an internal battle between Erdogan and I don't even know if it's the Saudi prince, the Saudi establishment, which in the beginning established and funded the Muslim Brotherhood some years ago. But the Muslim Brotherhood turned away, and now they're mortal enemies of the Saudis. It reminds me of another Arab proverb. Today you have honey, tomorrow you eat onions, meaning today is great and happy, and tomorrow it's bad. This is what they do to each other over again. So the alliances that they make, including with the United States, are really always temporary.
Yeah, that's clear and important to keep in mind. When we think about this in the strategic context, let's tease this out a little bit more. You've talked with me on this program many times about Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the dictator of Turkey, his bona fides as a Sharia supremacist and champion of Islamism and Sharia's, you know, domination of the world with the help of the Muslim Brotherhood is a matter of record. He is also aligned with Qatar, which is also aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood and opposed to the royal family of Saudi Arabia at the moment. They also have this Shiite regime of Iran that all three of them are making common cause with, specifically against the Saudis. So it's a complicated business. But is there any question in your mind, Harold Rode, that at the moment, maybe it's just for the moment, but at the moment, at the very least, this coalition of enemies of Saudi Arabia are far and away the greater evil as far as we're concerned and our interests, including Israel, by the way, relative to the lesser evil that the Saudis under this crown prince represent?
Well, let's put this into context. Our relationship at the moment with the Saudis and with the Sunni powers is a, I would call it, tactical alliance. But in the long run, once Iran has a new regime, and I think we're getting closer to that day, once Iran has a new regime, then there'll be what will eventually develop, I believe, is a strategic alliance with the United States, with Israel, with Iran, everybody against, shall we say, the Sunni world. Now, this may not be a nice thing to say, but it's, I think, the right thing. How do we handle all of this at the moment? When our enemies are fighting, our job in general should to look back, just sit back and watch them kill each other. There's a British phrase, I think I remember, when thieves fall out, honest men sleep at night.
I think Henry Kissinger had a variation on the theme in the Iran-Iraq war, saying he hoped that they would both lose. And I get the point. The issue at the moment, Harold, as you know, is that the government of the United States, the president and his administration specifically at the moment, but increasingly, I suspect, after the elections, we'll see evidence of this in the Congress as well, are feeling as though there must be punishments meted out to the Saudis. The president has designated a few people as implicated in this crime and therefore sanctioned them. But what would be your broader policy prescription? Sitting back is a passive thing, but actively, what do you do in the response to the demands for action against the Saudi government? And what do you do against the Brotherhood and the Turks and the Qataris and the Iranians who might otherwise benefit from whatever punishment or at least rift develops between us and the Saudis at the moment?
Well, I would say that the Saudis will find the appropriate scapegoats. These are the people who did the bidding of the Saudi government at this, what appears to be the bidding of the Saudi government at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And, you know, from a political point of view, it may be a way out for us, a temporary thing, to support the Saudis when they make scapegoats of these people. I know this is an awful thing to say, but it is the reality of politics in the Middle East. We need to somehow get this behind us. I would say that this is a wonderful time to emphasize that, unfortunately, this is the way things are in the Middle East, and cite chapter and verse about what Iran is doing in Evin prison. That's the major prison where they torture and dismember people in Tehran. And to say, you know, and the way our president talks, he could easily say, look, unfortunately, this is the way things seem to be solved in the Middle East. We don't like that, but, you know, we can't do everything that we want to.
And it bears mentioning that, of course, Recep Erdogan has done some pretty horrible things to Turkish opposition members, including journalists. So, I mean, there's nobody who's innocent here. Harold, let me just ask you, one of the things that I've been recommending to try to minimize the chances that enemies of this country, who happen to be enemies of the Saudi regime at the moment, benefit from all of this is to use this as an opportunity at long last, whatever one is going to do to the Saudis, to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as the terrorist organization that it is, and thereby, you know, create pressures on the Turks who are helping them, and of course the Qataris who are helping them, and the Iranians who I think make common cause when they choose to, and most especially this this toxic group in operating, among other places, inside our own country to destroy us from within, as they say.
Totally agree. Yeah, it's an opportunity to talk against the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think it's important to say that Khashoggi, or Khashoggi as we call him in English, was no saint. And his girlfriend, by the way, also his girlfriend, his intended, was also very close to the senior members of Erdogan's political movement, party, whatever you wish to call it, the people that are running the Turkey at the moment. It's all interesting. I would say one other thing. Qatar is the smartest actor here. And for us, on one hand, they give us this amazing base, and our military, our navy is stationed there. But at the same time, Qatar is the one fanning the flames of hatred of the United States, hatred of the West, and we look the other way. It's time for us to call things as they are.
I couldn't agree more, Harold Rode. Let me ask you finally, in closing, there's some reporting going on today that Benjamin Netanyahu is in a difficult place over all of this because he had made an investment in Crown Prince bin Salman to essentially work with the Saudis in their mutual campaign against their mutual enemy, Iran. How do you see that from Israel, Harold? Is this a real problem for Netanyahu, or is this something that he and most Israelis understand is the nature of the people they're working with?
The answer is yes. They understand this is the nature of the Middle East. There are no good actors here. And the other is to quote Winston Churchill. He hated Stalin. He hated communism with a passion. But he hated Hitler even more. And he said, "I would work with the devil if it would help us take out Mr. Hitler."
But at this moment, Harold, how do you see the prospects for bin Salman being able to continue to work with Israel, among others, including the United States, in directions that are clearly opposed by the Turks, the Qataris, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Iranians?
I wouldn't be surprised if he even ends up of what we call MBS. If he, shall we say, takes the back seat, disappears from the scene a bit, and somebody else will come to the fore. He, for better or for worse, even though he's the beloved son of the senile ruler of Saudi Arabia at the moment, he'll find somebody else.
All right, we'll be following this closely, as will you. Harold Rode, thank you so much for all of your tremendous service to our country, and come back to us again soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It is a special delight to say, joined by one of the men I admire most from his time in government, as well as the service that he's been rendering to our government outside of it. His name is Richard Higgins, better known as Rich Higgins. He was a former explosive ordnance disposal guy in the Army, one of those Hurt Locker fellows. You've probably seen the movie. He went on to be a senior executive in the Defense Department, responsible for irregular warfare. Most recently, he served for a time on the National Security Council staff of President Donald Trump and has continued to render incalculably important service, including, among other things, by doing some extraordinary and extensive forensic analysis of what actually happened in the course of the murderous attack on Well, it sure looked to me like a lot of Trump voters types in Las Vegas a little over a year ago. Rich Higgins, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It is so good to have you, my friend, at a moment such as this.
Hey, Frank. Thanks. Good to talk to you.
I know you're a little under the weather, so I appreciate you taking the time. A fellow that you have been raising a warning about by the name of Brian Hodge, an Australian national, has been getting a little bit of attention from the press at long last. I don't know whether that means he's getting attention from the law enforcement authorities or not, but can you give us some background on him and what you have found suggests he may have a role in what went down in Las Vegas a year ago?
Well, immediately after the attack, we watched various crowdsourcing platforms in the digital open media space. And Mr. Hodge came to the attention of some various users who were just observing the media transpiring around the attack. And Mr. Hodge did a series of 8 interviews, 6 on the radio and 2 on television, in which he provided a ton of information to these various media personalities, but all back in his home country of Australia. And it's interesting to note that one of the first groups, actually the first group after the attack to claim the attack, was actually Antifa, located out of Melbourne, Australia. So when we went and we reviewed these 8 interviews that he had done, we found all sorts of information in there that was inside knowledge.
Could you give us an example of something that he could only have known because he was somehow inside this operation?
Within a very short time frame after the attack, an hour or two at most, he knew that a security guard had been shot. He knew that a hammer had been used to break the window.
A specialized hammer, as I understand it.
Correct. He knew that, and I think this one really jumped out at me as a former military person. He knew that he says in one of these interviews, there were 100 odd shots, which, I talked to guys who'd been in special forces for 30 years, and they didn't know what weapon they were hearing when they first came out. If you remember, there was a big question as to whether or not there were belt-fed machine guns and other things because of the cyclical rate of fire was so odd. And only a couple of days later did we learn that he'd utilized bump stocks.
Somebody had used bump stocks, right?
Correct. But somehow Mr. Hodge knew that there were 100 odd shots given, which is strange given the fact that Mr. Paddock used 100 round surefire magazines, which are, they're a specialty item. They're not something that everybody knows even exist.
Right. So you had this character with inside knowledge talking to the press. He was also apparently saying some things in the course of those interviews that simply didn't add up. For example, his whereabouts in the immediate aftermath of the event, right?
Correct. His initial story was that he hid in the bushes outside of the hotel, having escaped the hotel through a quote-unquote kitchen. I don't know how many people leave a hotel through a kitchen, but remember, if you saw the videos of the attack, most of the people in the hotel didn't even know the attack was going on. And so he claims to have been on the 32nd floor at the time of the attack, left through an elevator, went out and escaped the hotel through a kitchen and hid in the bushes for 3.5 hours. And that just made no sense to anybody. And so we began looking more closely into him. What we found was really interesting. Various networks that you would think the police would take an interest in them. You would think that the FBI would take an interest in them. And apparently they did not.
Give us some examples of the kinds of things that you turned up, Rich. And again, you're a citizen. You don't have law enforcement powers or tools at your disposal, but you just employing the tools that you did have access to were able to find some information. Give us some examples of that, if you would.
International travel patterns that we could discern through his Facebook and social media activity that were very interesting. We found that he had, while denying in his radio interviews any understanding of weapons, we found through his social media accounts that he is very familiar with weapons to the point that he was taking his friends shooting at the Los Angeles Gun Club. Just a whole bunch of things like that. But most interesting, we found his social media included contacts and connections to various jihadi-type organizations, including those that offer Umrah and Hajj-type services. So, outwardly facing anyways, facially, Brian Hodge doesn't appear to have anything that would lead you to believe he had anything like that in his social media contacts, but for some reason he did.
And what was his professional story, and how might that have featured into his proximity to this attack and his ability perhaps even to help plan it.
He's a concert producer and a promoter, and he claims to have been in town preparing for a private concert that was to take place later in that week. However, the band that he cites as the band that he was supporting was actually in Reno that week. You know, we've identified just through open source data analysis, 5 or 6 provable lies inside of his statements that he made to the media. And what we just could not get over was the fact that law enforcement seems to have just completely missed this guy.
And here's the other thing that I was struck by in some of the reporting or briefings, at least, that you've done on this. You mentioned at the outset of this interview, Rich Higgins, that he was from Australia. It's my understanding he's from Melbourne. And you mentioned also that Antifa in Melbourne was one of the first to come up on the net and take credit for this attack. Is that right? Or at least comment favorably upon it?
Correct. The actual Facebook for Melbourne Antifa posted about 45 minutes after the attack that, quote unquote, one of our comrades from Las Vegas has made these fascist Trump-supporting dogs pay. It's also important to note that we know that Paddock was searching these concert venues that he was doing reconnaissance of. And actually, we know in the police report that he was querying who the attendees of these venues would be. My supposition being that he was looking for where the highest number of Trump supporters would be. It's also important to note that he did not randomly shoot at people on the street, buses going by, and he focused his fire or their fire on the concert venue itself, which tells me that there was something about those concert attendees that made them the target of choice.
Yeah. And just to complete this line of inquiry, is there any evidence that you've come across that would make an actual connection between Brian Hodge and the Antifa operation in Melbourne or elsewhere?
We haven't found anything where, you know, there's not a membership card. And that's one of the real challenges with Antifa, because their operational methodology is very sophisticated. It's very much of the communist anarchist in its nature. And, you know, Antifa deploys in what they call black bloc. They try and remain anonymous. But what you'll see is there's a pattern of far leftist postings in Mr. Hodge's social media accounts that would lead you to believe that if he did have some sort of a political inclination, it would certainly hew in that direction. We also know that he was the victim of an attack by right-wingers back in Australia, which may have been, you know, sort of his motivation.
Rich, we're at the end of our time. Let me just first of all say thank you for the work you've done on this. I'm sure there will be people who say, well, this sounds like some sort of conspiracy theory, especially since the law enforcement community doesn't seem to have picked up on it. Our friend Andrew McCarthy has reported to me in the past that back when he worked in the Southern District of New York for Rudy Giuliani as the assistant U.S. attorney, that they had an adage in the office that every conspiracy begins with a conspiracy theory. And in this case, there seems to be an awful lot of factual information. And I must say, in 40 years of working on national security matters, I've never seen anything remotely like what has happened in this affair, where you've gone for a full year with basically no full disclosure by the federal authorities as to what happened when scores of Americans were hurt or killed. And the theory that one guy did all of this just doesn't seem to compute. So again, thank you for the work that you're doing. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.